We are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. Today we are in Bagno di Romagna.
Yeah, my Fraile there and his Suanya with the cries of delight. He's always someone who's always smiling in races, and that grin is extra wide now. I saw Tom Dumoulin and Vincenzo Nibali talking at the finish line. Dumoulin was motioning to Nibali in a sort of circular motion, suggesting that maybe Nibali should have been taking more turns on the front. Just here, I think Nibali stopped just up the road here. Big scrum of journalists. Nibali is in the middle of it. Let's see what he's got to say.
Ho visto che hai parlato con la maglia rosa alla fine.
No, qua lui nel finale mi ha detto.
In the finale, Dumoulin said to me we should all work together. I said to him, look, I'm on my own, I'm not pulling. If I had a teammate, okay, I'd put him on the front. But Pellizzotti crashed today. He got a real whack, and we'll have to see how he is tonight. He was there again in the finale, so at least that's encouraging. Visconti was in the break. I don't know what he did in the end. He was feeling good and we tried to be smart tactically. Honestly, I expected Nairo to attack on the last climb, but he stayed put. He had three teammates up the road, which made me think he could make a move, but he didn't in the end.
I'm
going to try and chase a few of the protagonists of the stage. Thibaut Pinot, he's just escaped through the crowd. I'm going to follow him back to the Française des Jeux bus. Obviously, pretty encouraging day for him, even if he didn't gain any significant time. Well, he didn't gain any time in the end, but good for his morale, I think, that he was able to drop some of the main challenges for at least for a while. Here he is.
Ouais, j'ai tenté. Je pensais que peut-être qu'il y en aurait plusieurs qui.
Yes, I tried. Thought that a few guys would be motivated because they had no teammates left. With three or four guys, you never know. But then the wind was against, and no one wanted to really go for it. So I sat up. The heat doesn't scare me, but I also know that I have teammates and staff working hard to make sure it's not an issue. That means a lot of water bottles, lots to eat. It's a big effort on everyone's part. Anyway, I'm happy to have dealt with it today. We think you lost 44 seconds, Geraint. How were you feeling out there?
Oh, I was just suffering all day. And I had a really sore knee as well, but I was just trying to get to finish as best I could, really.
Still from the crash, the knee?
Yeah, for sure. Just felt worse than yesterday. You know, it was only an hour yesterday effort, whereas today is like, you know, 4.5 or whatever. And yeah, I was just suffering all day, and it wasn't good out there.
Are you still sort of making your mind up about whether to dig in and try and finish as high up on GC as possible, or are you starting to think of stage wins already?
Yeah, I don't think just play it day by day and see how I get through the next 2 days, and then see how I am on the next sort of GC day, and then after that I guess you have a clearer picture and can decide. I'm just looking forward to getting to the hotel and going to bed, but then a couple of easy days hopefully will play to my advantage.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney, and that was Daniel Freeb down at the finish line in Bagno di Romagna this afternoon at the finish of stage 11 of the Giro d'Italia.
Speaking, you make it sound as though something terrible has happened to me and I'm not here. Sitting opposite you.
Well, I'm explaining to the listeners that okay, they can't see this.
Okay.
You should have caught on. It's not television, you know. It's not television. And you spoke, Daniel, to Vincenzo Nibali, Thibaut Pinot and Geraint Thomas at the finish line of what was an absorbing and very aggressive stage of the Giro. There was all kind of suspicion that there might be some sort of Movistar-led ambush of Sunweb and Tom Dumoulin, and to a degree there was.
We'll get to that, Lionel. We'll get to that. Where are we? Where are we, Lionel?
We're still in Tuscany.
No. We're in Emilia now. Emilia? Oh, no, we're in Romagna.
We're in Romagna,
we're outside,
right,
Forlì, okay. Just outside Forlì, aren't we? Yeah. How the devil have you been anyway, Lionel? I haven't
I haven't seen you since breakfast this morning.
I've had a wonderful day, Daniel. I've been out watching the Giro on the road, had a nice lunch, watched the race on the final climb. Had a little bit of wine.
What did you drink? Rosso di... What's it called? It's always Sangiovese around here.
It was Sangiovese. I looked it up on Vivino, and Vivino, the app, wasn't terribly impressed. But it was perfectly fine. Went very well with our...
It was quaffable.
Didn't quaff too much, you know. Wanted to concentrate on the race. So shall I just do the tale of the tapper, and then we'll get on with what's gone on in the Giro today. It was stage 11. The start was just on the outskirts of Florence, the birthplace of Gino Bartali, great Italian rider from the 40s and 50s, of course. One Italian rider not having a great day is the Italian champion, Giacomo Nizzolo. Didn't start this morning, suffering with allergies. As I said, it was really aggressive racing. As soon as I was trying to catch up with what was going on, it seemed like the race had been blown into bits with a break up the road and then a much reduced peloton. A lot of pressure put on Tom Dumoulin's Sunweb team, and they stood up to it pretty well. We'll talk about that later in the episode. But the man of the day, Omar Fraile, won the King of the Mountains at the Vuelta last year, was impressive at the Tour de Yorkshire earlier this month, where he was second. Really impressive today because he'd been away with Mikel Landa for such a long time. They were being chased by 22 riders, and then behind that was what was left of the peloton. And Fraile, the Spanish rider, he pushed again on the final climb. It was actually Pierre Roland who made a little move, but Fraile was very, very alert to that. Got across, and then they were later joined by Rui Costa, who looked really strong coming across, as did Tanel Kangert of Astana a little bit later on, but arguably Costa and Kangert paid for the work that they had to do. In the finish straight, the chase group was almost upon them, but Fraile opened up the sprint. Very, very impressive. Held on to win the stage for Dimension Data. The overall picture, well, the big move really was that in that 22-man group was Andre Amador of Movistar. He's one of Nairo Quintana's key domestiques. At one point, he was up to second overall on the road, and tonight he is sixth. That's a real kind of leapfrogging move. They've sort of played drafts with him on the overall classification, haven't they, getting him back up to sixth. Stephen Kruiswijk of Lotto NL Jumbo and Geraint Thomas lost 48 seconds on the other GC riders. So overall, Dumoulin's advantage hasn't changed. Fraile is now tied with Jan Palanch on 44 points in the King of the Mountains. Gaviria is in Chicolomino, and Bob Jungels is in white. But what a day, Daniel.
Was, Lionel. A very hot day. We heard Thibaut Pinot speaking in that little opening package about having dealt well with the heat today, and he was very happy with that. But these stages in the Apennines, particularly in this region, when we go from Tuscany to Romagna or Emilia, they're often quite dangerous, quite perilous. I mean, in terms of, not in terms of sort of safety, but in terms of the damage they can cause to general classification. I remember a stage in the 2000 Giro to Prato, which Axel Merckx won. Very, very hard stage. I remember a stage in 2003, Gilberto Simoni absolutely ripped the race apart with a teammate, Leonardo Bertagnoli, and did big damage on GC. And you know, you looked at the profile today and you thought, well, it's medium mountain stage, but there are so many teams now who halfway through the Giro are already getting slightly worried about opportunities slipping away, and then the general classification has been blown open and you've already got a lot of guys in the position where they really need to gain time, and there was a lot to gain today, potentially. Like I said, very hot day. Movistar did what Movistar often do. They attacked en masse. A lot of people get frustrated watching Movistar because they seem to get themselves in great positions with guys down the road, with sort of secondary riders down the road, and you're sort of waiting for them to land the killer blow with Quintana or whoever their leader is behind, and that doesn't necessarily happen. It didn't happen today. But I think it was a great day for them. They've put Amador in a position where he can become a dangerous ally, a dangerous counterpuncher in general classification. And they've also put a bit of a dent in Sunweb, haven't they? I mean, I just looked at some of the power files of the Sunweb riders today, and it was a hard old day in the saddle, Lionel, for those guys. And they brought a very strong team here. This might be Sunweb's strongest team of the year, in fact. I can't envisage them having a stronger team at the Tour de France. They've got Geschko, who's a very good rider. They've got Preidler, is a good climber. They've already lost Wilco Kelderman, unfortunately, Chad Hager. But they're pretty well equipped. But today, they took a bit of a beating.
Well, they did very well, but at what cost? That's the thing, isn't it? They'll have a quietish day over the next two or three days before the weekend. But I mean, they were in a position where they had to do that work. Otherwise, that gap could have gone, you know, wildly out of control. And you would look around and think, well, who else is going to chase that? Because, I mean, would Bahrain have done anything, having Visconti in the group? Would they have just basically hung Dumoulin and Sunweb out to dry? Because he's still a slightly unknown quantity, particularly with that final week. So the real top, you know, Nibali, you know, even Pinot and Francis Desjeux, they can afford to just wait a little bit at the moment and see whether Sunweb are, you know, able to do their, you know, come undone all on their own.
Yeah, it was interesting in Tom Dumoulin's press conference. I mean, his cheekbones were looking magnificent as always. But he talks about the fact that, well, he and Sunweb had anticipated what Movistar were going to do. Today went pretty much exactly as they imagined that it would go. That said, they were kind of powerless to stop Amador gaining that time again. And, you know, Dumoulin is a very cool cat that the Italians are really taking to him in his press conference tonight. The press conferences are pretty much always the same in the Giro, especially when it's a foreign rider who's in the pink jersey. The Italian journalists love to know whether they love Italy. And that's generally the first question. Yeah, what is your relationship with Italy? Why do you love Italy? It's always the same. And I don't know why that is. I mean, I don't know whether the Italians are just very proud or very insecure about people not loving their country. And secondly, they ask about history. Hey, you know about the Fausto Coppi, Gino Bartali, because today was the Gino Bartali stage. And Dumoulin said, no, he didn't know. He wasn't great on cycling history, but he's learning more and more. And someone recommended a good book to him about Gino Bartali today, or in the last few days, they recommend it, and he's going to start reading it. I mean, and he's really charming them. I mean, the only way he could charm them anymore would be to rail against people drinking cappuccino after 11 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, let's not go there. We had an after 11 cappuccino, Simon, the photographer, and I, simply because you weren't with us, and we felt emboldened. Anyway, Andre Amador, let's not forget, he had a day in pink last year, didn't he? And we were having very similar conversation because in the Giro last year, Movistar came with Valverde and Amador was kind of seen as a potentially dangerous foil for Movistar. Not quite in the same position this year, quite simply because Quintana's already ahead of him, but it's not a bad position for them to be in, is it? And, you know, it's almost menacing, the strength that they have. Even their sort of non-climbers are good climbers, aren't they? And able to do an awful lot of work.
Yeah, and they do get a lot of flack for not being aggressive enough. I mean, I think they're extremely experienced now in managing Grand Tours. And, you know, you can go back to the days of the Reynolds team and the Benesto team, and it's a lot of the same personnel. I mean, Eusebio Unzué, he's the team manager now of Movistar, but he sort of masterminded or helped to mastermind a lot of Indurain's tour wins. And they've had this history going back, what, it's 30 years now, of managing leaders in Grand Tours. And to suggest that they don't know what they're doing or that they're not employing the best tactics, I mean, there might be the odd day where they get it slightly wrong, but they have seen and done absolutely everything in major tours.
Well, we'll talk about Sunweb a little bit more in the next part, but we should have a word about Omar Fraile and his stage win, because that was magnificent, wasn't it?
It was, and he's an incredibly engaging character. There aren't many people in professional cycling who smile more than he does. He's a real sort of happy-go-lucky character. I've spoken to him on a number of occasions over the last few months. He's very bashful about his English. Yes, he speaks okay English, but he always prefers to do interviews in Spanish. But it's always sort of an apology and a giggle and a no, we'll try next time in English. But he's a guy who they signed from Caja Rural 2 years ago, or Dimension Data 18 months ago. They picked him up. And he's won two mountains classifications in the Vuelta, which is not to be sniffed at. And, you know, it's a very different exercise winning mountains prizes, even in major tours. And you did wonder, could he make that step up to becoming a stage winner in a race like this at a time when Dimension Data really need someone to step up, because they've struggled this year with Cavendish being out and Cummings being out. And he did, and he said that he had been thinking about this stage for a long time. He'd sort of put a tick by this stage in the road book, and that makes it even more impressive to actually be targeting this stage and to pull it off. So I was quite happy for him, really.
My name is Morgan Frost. I am the front of house and cafe supervisor at Rafa's Imperial Works. I'm an avid listener of the Cycling Podcast. I think the people who have benefited from it most are probably my parents. I used to listen to the Cycling Podcast while I was still living with my folks. And whilst they were casual enthusiasts, listening to the Cycling Podcast and understanding the depth of the sport and the storytelling and the roller coaster of the season has really given them the breadth of knowledge and information that has led them from casual watchers to real enthusiasts.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kit and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
My name is Andrea Agostini. I'm an ex-friend of Marco Pantani. Marco Pantani was my one of the best friends of mine. And we trained all together for 20 years, more or less. And we was usual to train on this kind of course. Above all, when we have to do the long training day, our usual course was Balze. Is around 200k from Cesenatico and back. So we started from the sea. We came here around this amazing hill, and was maybe one of the best favorites course of Marco to train for the long training day, because was around 200k, as I said. And above all, when we were under 23, we needed to have one day around 5-6 hour of training. The only thing that can I say is all the time we came here on this kind of mountains, and we were, you know, 10-15 guys all together training, all the under 23, some professional rider of this zone. And Marco, got the top always alone, and after that is waiting for us with a big panino with prosciutto and a Coca-Cola.
So, Daniel, I was out on that climb.
Well, before you tell us about your day on the climb line, I was about to say, you know, we heard Andrea Agostini there, one of Pantani's great friends, a childhood friend, talking about how he would generally finish climbs. Pantani would, he'd be waiting at the top with a panino and a Coca-Cola, just waiting for the stragglers to arrive. It reminded me very much of yourself. I mean,
what, me being one of the stragglers or being at the top with the panini?
Mainly the eating a panino.
Well, I'd be one of the stragglers eating a panino, the double whammy, I think. But we're actually, as the crow flies, where we are now, probably less than 20 kilometres from Cesenatico, which was Pantani's hometown, of course. And the climb, I'd never heard of it before, the Fumaiolo. Simon and I went up to Balze today. Nice little village. I don't know how often the Giro's been over that climb in recent years.
Not terribly often.
Well,
no.
I mean, they really turned out for it. There was a big screen on the corner. Everything was pink, as you'd expect. Huge crowd, several people deep on the tight hairpin bend where I was standing. Really great atmosphere. Everybody just enjoying a very nice afternoon. I did see someone who could have been a Marco Pantani double, wearing full Mercatone Uno kit, the really faded, washed out version of the Mercatone Uno kit. Not my favourite era of that. It kind of pale yellow, turquoise, light blue.
That was Pantani's heyday. They were the salad days.
They were, but I preferred the earlier one, the darker version from a few years ago.
You didn't like the salad days.
No, I didn't. Oh dear. Well, I had a very nice dish of salad. We went into a restaurant and had some lunch, and it was a fixed menu for €20, several courses, antipasti, which was, you know, as you'd expect, ham, salami.
Tell me
salami.
About this. This is a big reveal at 7:45 in the evening.
Pickled vegetables. Is that common here? First time I've had pickled
vegetables.
Antipasti.
That's, we sort of had them. We had them in Civita, didn't we? In Calabria, but that was an Albanian restaurant, essentially.
After that, there was a little dish of lasagna. Then there was some ravioli with sage butter. Very nice. That's typical of here, isn't it?
Pretty typical, yeah.
And then we had some baked chicken or roasted chicken and rabbit. And then a plate of salad. And then a tiramisu. and a little bit of Sangiovese, not very much, but yeah, quite a large lunch. I'm not quite ready for dinner yet. So let's talk more about the Giro, because we mentioned about Sunweb. They did stand up pretty well to that. I'm not saying Wilco Kelderman would have been put a huge amount of work on a day like today, but missing him, that is a big hole in their team, isn't it, looking ahead at the rest of the race?
Yeah, I mean, he's someone who's really slipped under the radar outside of Holland. Two or three years ago, he's been talked up as the next big Dutch stage racing star, and then he had a couple of, well, certainly last season was pretty poor, and has reinvented himself really as a domestique, and he would have been invaluable to Tom Dumoulin. But Tom Dumoulin is very, very confident. He said he's not scared of anything, anyone, looked incredibly relaxed, and, you know, he's having to do his press conference every night in the pink jersey, but I'm just talking to the team's press officer yesterday, Peter Reif, and he said, and I've heard this before, and this is quite a common thing that you hear, that it's actually a bit of an advantage in a way to have everything organised after a stage, and that is the case for the guys leading the race. You know, they get chaperoned from the podium or from the podium to the press conference to anti-doping and so forth and so forth, whereas it can be a bit of a bum fight for some of the other guys. So Dumoulin's looking menacing, as you said, Lionel. He also talks in his press conference glowingly about Laurens ten Dam, the veteran domestique who himself a few years ago, after a very good performance in the Tour de France, was talked up as a, you know, Holland's great white hope for the Grand Tours, and has since, he's also reinvented himself as a domestique deluxe, famous for his barbecuing fetish, of course, or barbecuing obsession, and probably a better word.
And at this time last year, certainly held the Strava record for Mont Ventoux. Not sure if that's been beaten yet.
Did he now?
Yeah.
Well, I spoke to Laurens ten Dam yesterday, Lionel. Now, it's quite a long interview, so we're going to hear it in two parts. We're going to hear one part tonight. We're going to hear him talking about Tom Dumoulin. We're going to hear him talking about barbecues. There was a barbecue a couple of nights ago in the Sunweb camp. And yeah, tomorrow we're going to hear him comparing the three Dutchies contending for this Giro d'Italia, Steven Kruiswijk, Tom Dumoulin and Bauke Mollema, and Laurens ten Dam has ridden with all of them.
So Laurens, I understand yesterday the staff had a barbecue. Were you doing the grilling?
Yeah, I left it to our Brazilian guy. You know, they had only the dirty meat, the sausages and some minced meat, but no real tri-tip or stuff like that. But I came up with the idea to do a big barbecue in Milano instead of going to a fancy restaurant. I think it would be a lot more fun and we could invite a lot more people and drink a lot more wine. So maybe that's an opportunity for Milan.
And we know how important you are for this team as one of the older members of the team. I mean, how important, being modest, are you for Tom? Do you have to give, or are you giving Tom a lot of advice, or is he kind of dealing with things on his own?
No, sure, but I think the most advice I've already given him in the last few years, you know, and I started training with him in 2012, 2013, so that's 4 or 5 years ago, and he started to, we discussed things a lot, and right now he's on the point, he knows himself a lot, you know, but still we discuss a lot of things and talk about the race, about tactics, about nutrition, about training, about everything actually, but I think he's now a grown-up athlete, you know. Mm-hmm. When I started to know him, he was still young, you know, obviously, and he was growing, and now he's grown up.
You know the situation. You've been in the position where, well, the Dutch are crying out for a Grand Tour winner, especially a Tour de France winner. And you had your experience where you were finished sixth in the Tour, was it?
No, at the end I was ninth, but I was a long time top five that year till the Ventoux stage, or the second rest day, and the amount of press there was that year was crazy. Yeah, things like that are looking better and better for the Dutch, because we've got three guys top 10 right now. Well, I remember I was the first Dutch guy in 2009 in a Giro, lonely at like 30th place in GC or something, and now three guys are really competing, so things are looking bright for Dutch cycling.
How hard did you find it to deal with that expectation that came after that Tour de France? The year afterwards.
That's difficult. I remember 2014 I had a shit spring, you know, and then I managed to get top 10 in the Tour anyway, but 2015 it caught up with me, and I tried to repeat the previous 2 years. It didn't work out, and I didn't like the cycling anymore so much, and that made me to do the decision. Like, I started to dislike it after, I think, 13 years of being pro. I disliked it for like 3-4 months, and I made the decision to move to the US with the family, and had a quite easy year, and now I'm back on track and like it again, you know, in a different role, you know, so the pressure is a little bit off me. But yeah, pressure is a thing, especially in Holland, where we're waiting since Zoetermelk, I think, for a Grand Tour winner. So that's been a while.
And for someone who doesn't know Holland, do you think it's a specific kind of pressure in Holland? Because it's a small country and the media is very much, well, it's very interested in cycling. We've got a lot of Dutch journalists here. There's a particular kind of pressure in Holland.
Yeah, no, it's... I think everybody's really happy and excited. We have three guys like that right now, you know, like really competing. And the funny thing is they all aim for the Giro this year. So it comes all together in this race. And that's why we have extra journalists. We have every night. Yeah, there's like an extra on the national television. There is an extra show and they talk about all the things going on. And for me, it's nice to see everything from the closest, you know, like in the race on the last climb. And I hope to be there as long as possible the upcoming weeks.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Ten Dam, he's Dutch, obviously, but lives in California. The Tour of California is on at the moment. I don't know what's going on over there. So, sorry if you're tuning in for Tour of California news, but you probably won't be getting any here. But he's over here, obviously, doing the Giro. And could find himself with a very big role to play in the final week.
Yeah, he's a very good rider, a very strong rider in the mountains. And it's interesting just listening to him in that interview, but also having spoken to him about this before, the move to the United States was, I think, partly motivated by the pressure that he felt under after that great Tour de France that he rode a few years ago, and didn't really enjoy that role, that status of being Holland's next big hope, and put a lot of pressure on himself. And, you know, I think we talked yesterday about how desperate Holland is to find their next Grand Tour superstar. And Ten Dam kind of internalized a lot of that. And I think, you know, moving to the United States was part escape. I mean, it was partly sort of fulfilling a dream as well. He was someone who'd always loved the United States when he'd gone there. But yeah, he is an interesting character. It will be interesting to see how Dumoulin reacts to that pressure over the coming weeks. And if he wins this Giro d'Italia, beyond that, because obviously if he does win the Giro, the next challenge for him is going to be winning the Tour, isn't it? And you would think, based on the roots of the Tour de France in the past, not necessarily this year, but the Tour is a race that will suit him better.
Especially if they have a year a la Wiggins with sort of big time trials and relatively light climbing. Yeah, he's got everything that a Tour winner, you know, would need. And the Giro, in a funny way, does suit him less. And yet here he is giving it everything to try and win it. It'd be really interesting to... Well, I'll be back at home next week, but it'd be very interesting to see just how deep he goes and whether he can... Whether that experience of losing the Vuelta the way he got so close, didn't he, a couple of years ago, you know, mentally that must stand him in good stead. He must have learned something from that experience, and he's another 18 months older for a start and got a bit more experience. But we shall see.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
My name's Lauren Delaney and I'm a performance nutritionist at British Cycling. And I work specifically with the sprint and BMX athletes and the para cycling athletes as well. Caffeine is probably one of the most researched supplements that are out there in sport in general. We get caffeine from food anyway, from coffee, obviously. And I think it would be very difficult to put it back on the banned list. I think it's very important to use caffeine in a strategic way because of obviously some of the consequences you can have from it. Just kind of the effect of having too much caffeine, which we've probably all experienced at one point. I think it's very important in terms of sports nutrition. A lot of our athletes do use it and you can't really deny that they do. And whether it's from coffee, cyclists in general are always big advocates of coffee in general. I think it's important from our perspective to use caffeine in a very strategic way. And I think with using coffee alone, that's quite difficult because every cup of coffee will have a different amount of caffeine. And that's why I suppose the likes of the caffeine gels, for example, from SAS are quite handy because we know exactly how much caffeine is in them. And we can be quite strategic in terms of what times during the day to have them so that it doesn't influence sleep later at night or their gut function.
I'm Dr. Rob Child. I'm a performance biochemist at Team Katusha, and my job there is involved with applying, again, nutritional science to individual riders to maximise their performance and their health. Yeah, there's no question that it can be a performance aid. Its effectiveness will be very much reduced by your habitual caffeine intake. If you actually reduce your caffeine intake, then you can get quite a big psychological and physical hit, even from a dose as low as 100 milligrams of caffeine. And that's what's in some of the SIS gels. Probably the same strength as a strong cup of tea or a strong coffee. So yeah, it definitely works.
Hi, I'm Chris Hoy, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast, supported by Science and Sport. As an athlete, you don't spend the time in the pub, so the cafe becomes your social hub. So when you're in a training camp or when you're, you know, on a rest day, you don't go to the pub, go to the cafe. Particularly if you're in Australia or somewhere nice and warm that has good coffee, that's where I really started to get into my coffee. And then you suddenly realise that caffeine, used in the right way, in the right quantities, can help you. And it can be as simple as just in the morning before a session, helping to wake you up, you know, make you perceive that feeling of being a bit more alert. But actually it can help, you know, to mobilize fats and to use fat, to burn fat for endurance rides. So a lot of the guys will get up and take on some caffeine, have 30 or 40 grams of protein and start a long ride. So, I mean, it's not the sort of thing I used to do because, I wasn't trying to lose weight. I was trying to maintain my weight, if anything, or gain weight. But certainly the longer distance guys would get up, have some caffeine, have some protein, and then they would start consuming carbohydrate during the ride. And that would be a great way of burning fat, of maintaining lean mass, but not gaining fat or sustaining the fat. And you don't have to take much, and I don't think, you know, it's not about taking huge quantities, it's about taking a little bit, which can give you a lift and hopefully mobilize some fats or just make you feel a bit more alert. And also when you're racing possibly 12, 14 times a day on the track, a little gel sachet with some electrolytes and some caffeine in it can really give you a little perk up.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast all year, but particularly here at the Giro d'Italia. Their support, along with Rafa, our title sponsor, enables us to be here covering the race daily. That little segment you heard is Science in Sport talking about caffeine and caffeine in their gels, caffeine shots that they now produce. And I had a question, Daniel, when I had my 11:45 cappuccino this morning. Yeah. Is there the same amount of caffeine in a cappuccino as in just a regular coffee and
espresso
here?
Shot, isn't it?
Sometimes
you will get people who will put two espresso shots more in. You don't really get that in Italy. You get that in the UK and other places. But yeah.
It's the same cafe shot, coffee shot, but yeah. You just have the frothy milk on the top.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Milk and a dose of self-loathing if it's after 11 o'clock.
I'm not buying into that. I think it's fine. Anyway, Science in Sport also supply Team Sky, and they have joined up to give away an incredible prize bundle worth £5,000 to listeners of the podcast. The first place prize will receive a limited edition pair of Oakley Giro glasses. They're only worn by pro riders. You can't actually buy them. Also included in the prize is the best in market smart trainer, which is the Wahoo Kicker, and a year's supply of Science in Sport and Muckoff product, plus a signed Team Sky 2017 jersey. That's a pretty good bundle. There are also second and third place prizes worth £1,000 and £500 up for grabs. This is the competition I've been mentioning. I didn't know the details until it was emailed through to me today. Sadly, I can't enter. But if you want to enter, you can go to scienceinsport.com/thecyclingpodcast. Now, Daniel, you went off to Florence this morning and I went off to the climb. We went our separate ways. What did you get up to?
Well, I went for breakfast with Mark Cavendish and his best pal, Cal Crutchlow, who, it's funny actually, so Cal Crutchlow, a lot of listeners will already know, but he is one of the top MotoGP riders in the world. What was intriguing, Lionel, what is intriguing is that today we were in a region, obviously, that used to be famous for, or it was made famous partly by Marco Pantani, and he was the big idol, he was the big icon here. This is something we talked about in our Giro Friends special, that Pantani, in a lot of ways, was replaced in the hearts of Italian sports fans by Valentino Rossi. But in this particular region, he was really replaced by MotoGP riders and MotoGP as a sport, because it's very big in this region, and partly because there are racetracks near here. But also Marco Melandri is also from Cesena or Cesenatico, and Valentino Rossi is from Urbino, which is not far from here. So, and Cal Crutchlow, when he goes for breakfast with, you know, a co-host of the Cycling Podcast and Mark Cavendish, he gets recognised much more than Mark Cavendish. He was getting stopped and asked for selfies quite a lot. But anyway, we spoke to him last year, didn't we? He was at the stage, he was at the start in Florence last year, or near Florence. He lives close to Florence, as does Mark Cavendish, or Mark Cavendish has a house over there. They're best of buddies. They train together a lot. Cal Crutchlow is a very, very passionate cyclist, if you didn't already know, and as we'll hear now. So this is Cal Crutchlow speaking this morning in Florence. Cal Crutchlow, now traditional to see you at the Giro when the starts are in Florence. Remember you telling me last year you thought you could be here riding, you could be in the peloton. You're good enough now. You're definitely good enough now. Is that still what you think?
Well, I'm a year stronger, I think. No. Obviously, you know, my passion for riding the bicycle is fantastic. I like it a lot. But yeah, everything's going really good in the moment in MotoGP. And my form on the bicycle is good as well. So, but it's great to come here to Florence and see the start again. Obviously, I've come with Cav this time. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
You've been training a lot with Mark recently. He's obviously been struggling with illness, but is he behaving himself?
He's always behaving himself. Mark's Mark. Mark's a class act. He knows what to do and when to do it. And at the moment, as you know, he's not been feeling great. But I think he's making strong improvements with his health, first and foremost. And then he's also riding his bike great at the minute as well. So he'll be back soon.
I know you've been watching the Giro, Cal. What's your verdict so far? I mean, the first week, the pundits sort of said it was pretty boring, but it's come to life over the last 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, I haven't been watching it as much as I wanted to, simply with racing and travelling and then having a baby at home in the afternoon. But yeah, I want to Geraint to win. And obviously, it's a shame that he took a blow earlier on in the week. But it was nice to see him come back in the time trial yesterday. And it's going to be the same guys, I think, in the mountains, Quintana and Nibali. And hopefully Geraint can be there. And if they do one big day, and then they can get the time back. He needs me riding for him.
And maybe in a few years we'll see Coventry's answer to Peter Sagan taking part in one of these races. Because that's how you consider yourself.
Yeah, but it doesn't go down very well with Mark. No. But I'm in the Isle of Man now, and I can't race the Nationals this year, which I'm not too happy about, but anyway.
Yeah, Lionel, so that was Cal Crutchlow. A bit of a sad and alarming postscript to that interview. Today, I think, former MotoGP rider Nicky Hayden had a bad accident on his push bike. And, he's currently in hospital in very serious condition, I think. So, you know, fingers crossed that he gets well.
Indeed. How was Mark Cavendish this morning? And we're going to hear from him in tomorrow night's episode, aren't we, a little bit. What sort of spirits is he in?
I think he's struggled over the last few weeks, obviously, being away from races. He hasn't raced. Has he raced since Abu Dhabi? Maybe not since the Tour of Abu Dhabi. He's been suffering with this Epstein-Barr virus. Doesn't really know whether he's going to make it in time for the Tour de France. He's really up against it. So, yeah, I think we'll find out, Lionel, over the next few weeks we'll find out whether he's going to make it in time for the Tour de France. But I think it's something that he's evaluating on a day-by-day basis, and it's something that he knows he has to be very careful with. And I think Cavendish, his problem with this virus is that he's someone who trains in a quite particular way. He's not someone that goes out for easy rides. He's not someone that particularly even goes out for recovery rides. He's always, throughout his career, had one way of training, and that's generally been going hard. And, you know, they might be quite short rides, but they're intense rides. And that's not really what the doctor has ordered for someone suffering from this virus.
Yeah, that must be really tough, just pootling along, because, you know, it's uncertain how long it's going to take for this virus to ebb away. But going out and just sort of turning the pedals over, not really Mark Cavendish's style, is it?
Talking of just turning the pedals over, did you notice today, Lionel, there was a very feisty conversation between Luca Shinto. So we heard from Luca Shinto a few days ago. He's the Villa Triestina, or Villa Selitalia, director sportive, quite a character. We heard from him about, well, he threatened, or he wanted to send all of his riders home because they weren't getting in enough breaks. And he was sort of placated for a couple of days because our friend Fonzie, Lionel, he in particular was quite prominent over the weekend, and they were getting in breaks. And then today was a stage when Bardiani, in particular, Bardiani are from very close to here, they would have been targeting, they would have known that a break was going to go. And Villa Selitalia, similar, they knew a break was going to go and they had to get guys in it, and they didn't manage. And Luca Shinto looked incandescent on the road.
During the race, he had a couple of riders next to him, car window open, waving his arm in a stereotypical Italian-type way. The rider didn't look like he was responding terribly well to the pep talk, it has to be said.
And meanwhile, we've got Pippo Pozzato, a friend of the podcast, and the Peacock of Sandrigo, who is going on Italian TV every single night. And apparently the other Italian teams are getting a little bit peeved about this because he's getting a lot of publicity for his sponsor, for Sell Italia, for Villa. And he knows this and he's playing the game very smartly, but he's not riding terribly well.
Well, the thing is, if the Italians want to get some of that limelight, they need to step up and get some results, don't they? Still no Italian stage win, 11 stages down, 10 to go. So over halfway without a stage win and without a day in the pink jersey. This is turning into a pretty bad 100th Giro for the home nation.
They've served us some lovely meals, Lionel, so they're fine.
They have indeed. Well, the Italian hopes, well, there are a couple of sprint stages coming up. The Italian hopes aren't helped by Nuzzolo going home. Where do their chances lie? Modolo, Sasha Modolo, maybe?
You see, I'm not particularly alarmed by this because I just feel that it's the continuation of a trend that has... began a few years ago for Italian cycling. So I kind of think that if they have won stages in the last 3 or 4 years, it's almost been more by luck than judgment or any real prowess. I mean, they're still a very strong cycling nation, but they're one of many now, and they've got some good riders in this race. I think, you know, someone like Valerio Conti, I would look for him to be down the road and a threat in breaks later in the race, in the mountains in particular. But when we're talking about stage wins in the mountains a la Pedal, the only person we would really expect to come up trumps would be Nibali, wouldn't it?
Yeah. What's a la Pedal in Italian? Do they have an equivalent?
No, I'm trying to think. No. Maybe I'll go away and I'll give you an answer tomorrow.
But basically it means somebody who wins because of their class.
Because they're in a lucky break.
Got you. Yeah, sure. Right, well, we had better leave it there because it's almost dinner time, Daniel. Before we go, just want to mention that nominations are being accepted for this week's Pedaleur de Charme Award. The second of the RAFA-produced T-shirts will be up for grabs. We'll be drawing up a shortlist towards the weekend and then opening a vote. So anyone that you see doing some charming pedaling, do let us know either on Facebook or on Twitter at cycling_podcast. It can be anything really. We don't like to dwell on people who have just had really bad luck with a crash. I know there's a fair groundswell of support for Geraint Thomas, but it should be for the way Geraint Thomas reacted rather than the fact he crashed. We don't want to give a prize for somebody who's hit the deck.
No, but I was about to say, you can't really stress enough not only professional, but just what a class act Geraint Thomas is. When, you know, today was another day when he'd had a tough old time. He was hurting. He'd lost time, and you know it's more and more frequent for riders in that position or in that state to, you know, give the press a wide berth to walk straight past them. And Geraint Thomas could easily have done that tonight. And again, he stopped, spoke very patiently. And so I think he's done himself a lot of credit.
Yeah, that's a perfectly valid reason to nominate him. Just coping with adversity in such a charming way. But yeah, we don't want to be rewarding. Well, rewarding is the wrong word, but we don't want to give a prize because somebody's fallen off their bike. That's for sure. Anyway, just speaking of RAFA very briefly, if you're in one of the cities that's home to one of the RAFA clubhouses, they'll be showing the Giro every day. So have a look at the RAFA website and see if there's one near you. But Daniel, I think that's it. We need to the kitchen is starting to smell.
Just one thing I've just remembered, Lionel, we haven't mentioned them for a few days. Our fantastic music on the Giro comes from Amaraterra. Look them up.
Somebody asked today, what is the name of the track that we
Cozze, which means muscles.
C-O-Z-Z-E. Yeah.
Which means muscles.
And they've got a website, haven't they? Amaraterra.co.uk. If you use Google, you'll find them. They're not on Spotify. They should be on Spotify, so I can put them on my playlist. Anyway, that's enough for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Lionel.
A reminder that you can watch the Giro d'Italia live and exclusive on Eurosport and Eurosport Player. UK viewers can also watch highlights of each stage at 10 p.m. on free-to-air channel Quest. There's a special offer for the Eurosport player, £29.99 for an all-access pass for the rest of 2017. Details of availability, compatible devices and full terms and conditions can be found on the Eurosport Player website, uk.eurosportplayer.com. You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA. Thanks to them and thanks to our other sponsors, Science and Sport and Maserati, and to All Press Espresso for supporting our morning show, Kilometre Zero. The music in this episode is by Amara Terra. Thanks to them. Thanks to those who help keep us on the road, in particular David Luxon, Jonathan Rowe, Nick Christian and Simon Gill. And thanks to Will Jones, who produced this episode.